Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us live for the weekly update here. In fact, Malcolm's at a family simcha, so we take the opportunity to start off by wishing him a mazel tov here at JM and the AM. Good morning, Mr. Honlein.
Good morning, and thank you. It's Shmuel Bach is putting on tefillin for the first time, so I'm broadcasting here from the yeshiva in North Jersey, and I'm sure that many listeners who are affiliated with the yeshiva are regulars, and so I will be able to see them in a little while.
Yeah, you're going to be bombarded. People are going to be after you for answers.
Actually,
this morning.
Say everything double now, right?
Certainly.
We are an echo.
Certainly all the good stuff, that's for sure. So time really flies, doesn't it? Unbelievable.
It's truly amazing.
Young man.
Thank God, and it's a real simcha, and you see the continuity in front of your eyes. It's very encouraging and rewarding.
Unbelievable. All right, after we left the air last week, immediately the news cycle for us began. We'll talk about the shakeup in the Israeli political scene, which we alluded to last week. But one thing we couldn't allude to last week was the completely unexpected episode up in Connecticut when the madman went in and committed mass murder. And in our context, obviously, I mean, we've been saying it all week, and the country and the world is in shock, and certainly, Malcolm, we welcome your comments in general. But in terms of our community, I believe, and I said this the moment this occurred, sometimes our educational institutions don't realize that in addition to circumstances like last Friday, there are other circumstances that could prompt somebody to try to take action, God forbid, against a Jewish institution. And you could cite plenty of examples in your career where you've seen Jewish institutions be targeted. This is a good opportunity, Malcolm, to remind schools and those identifiably Jewish institutions that they have to take security very seriously.
As you know, for a long time, for years on this program, I have spoken about it and in many other fora, and we created Secure Community Network US at scnus.org. I've urged people to go to the website. I've made proposals about suggestions based on the briefings from security people about the steps that can be taken by schools that don't necessarily cost a lot of money. I mean, I see how quickly everybody ran for the grants that the Department of Homeland Security offered, but they don't run with such alacrity to implementing security measures, including having parents stand at the door, having cameras, having a small disposable camera that, if, in case there's somebody suspicious, they get a picture so they can properly be described. And we did tabletop exercises, which is a term used for these exercises where people are run through what to do in case there is a shooter. Many lives were saved in Connecticut because the teachers were ready. They knew to take kids into the classroom. At the moment, you can't think. You have to act instantly and automatically. It has to be an instinctive reaction. And that it only comes about because people were trained.
Right.
And it means that every teacher and the kids have to be run through drills. And the kids didn't panic. And we saw that teacher was killed, you know, right, protecting the students. But just think if they hadn't taken that measure, what would have happened? How many more lives might have been lost? I actually wrote a piece, an open letter to the community, to the schools, especially in community centers, which I will put out this week, because right away everybody reacts immediately. But within a few days, and we saw it after every tragedy, even after 9/11, it may take a little while, but it dissipates, and people go back to life as usual, and they may have been committed and meant to do something, but they actually don't implement it.
Also, I think there's a, you know, sometimes we talk about being insulated, and everybody obviously to a degree in our community is, no matter, you know, to a degree, and you know what I mean by that, but I think people don't understand what type of potential target they are. And like I alluded to earlier, you could cite many examples around this country, even around this country in the U.S. We know what happened in France last year. I mean, the yeshivas and schools don't understand how, again, it may not be a mental health patient, but it could be somebody who wants to target this community. And by the way, would you say anything differently to those who observe other religions, right?
No, it's true of everybody and every institution. You can have people who have a gripe. You can have people who are just looking for a target. Or you remember what happened at the Jewish Federation in Seattle, at the Jewish Community Center in L.A. I mean, we've had Jewish institutions attacked, and we've had fatalities at these in these attacks. So it's not a hypothetical. We know how many cases of attempted or plotted attacks there are and every year here in America, and many of them, or quite a few of them, include Jewish institutions. I don't know what it takes to get people to wake up to this reality, but this is our responsibility, and we will be held to account. So it's not a question of bemoaning the fact after the fact, after the act, but to take the steps now so that at least you can say everything possible was done.
And cameras and checking out multiple entrances and accesses to buildings, all this stuff. Is, I mean, I don't want to go through the whole list.
And training, and our SCAN people will help them. If they call ScanUS or go, just go to the website, scanus.org, and log in, see what they have. They have online training. They have online training where people can, and principals and others, can see what has to be done. And if they need somebody to come out, we will see to it that somebody will come out and visit them.
Okay. And finally, because this seems to be the hottest topic in America now, I'm not asking you for your position on gun control, and it's not for us to sit here and debate it. But do you, as a Jewish leader, sometimes cringe when members of our community at the forefront of a movement that is ready to remove certain liberties from American citizens, even though I know we're talking about you know, high-powered assault weapons, and you know, obviously everybody knows what its purpose is, etc. But when anybody is out there trying to express how certain liberties should be suppressed, does that scare you as a Jewish leader?
I think the protection of life is first and foremost the concern, and whatever steps are necessary within the bounds of the law. The Constitution sets parameters, and the Constitution has to be honored. That is the safeguard. And you don't override those freedoms and those protections. But on the other hand, we have to look at the balance with protecting life.
It's a tough issue.
Very tough. Thank God I'm not a politician who has to speak about those issues.
Right. All right. So a couple of things that happened right after we left. This was obviously one of them that happened after we left the air on Friday and has been dominating the news cycle in the entire country. And so many people in our community are focused on it. And again, we encourage all the institutions, schools, shuls, and otherwise identifiably Jewish. Remember, there needs to be heightened security. The other story that we heard immediately after we left the air last week was the foreign minister of Israel resigning his post, and Avigdor Lieberman is no longer foreign minister. So a couple of questions. Is he still a member of Knesset? Is anybody else the foreign minister, or does the prime minister take over that portfolio? And what does this now do to the a January election?
Very good questions. Well, first of all, the prime minister does assume the foreign ministry, the foreign minister position. Normally, the deputy foreign minister might assume it, but in this case, it was Dani Ayalon, who is not continuing. Lieberman did not rename him to the list, and therefore he will not continue. But the Knesset did extend his term last Sunday night in a special session, so he is still the deputy foreign minister. The prime minister is the foreign minister. Mr. Lieberman resigned the post, and I think a minister under indictment is required to. The indictment was to have come down, and they postponed it because they said there's some new information that they have to review. Frankly, after 16 years of investigation, as he pointed out, wow, the charges are relatively minor. The major charges were dropped, but he is still running on the ticket for the next election, and you can remain a member at Knesset, and you have immunity, et cetera, but he still, if he's indicted, he will go to trial. So he stepped down because they would have brought the opposition would have brought lawsuits and forced him down. He therefore can still run, and he's trying to force the police to take the action and resolve the case before the January 22nd election.
Last week, you told me that you did not agree with my assessment that this is the way Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted things to go. 7 days later, have you changed your mind at all?
That he wanted it to go with Lieberman?
Yeah, meaning that he wanted him to be forced to be resigned and was happy about the indictment, because this way, all those who are critical of Netanyahu joining with Lieberman, it's a much more watered-down relationship now.
I don't think the relationship is, in fact, watered down, and I still stand by what I said the last time. I don't think that anybody wants to see another scandal. We know the people of Israel are tired of them, and too many elected officials have been through it. So I think it's more of a negative still, because the parties are integrated. So I don't see the upside for Netanyahu.
So do you think this will hurt him, or it's a...
Oh, it could. I think with some people, you know, it just brings it to the fore again. Although the cloud hanging over him all these years obviously would have become an issue as well.
So the story today is that Naftali Bennett made a statement regarding how he would not carry out and not encourage orders that would expel Jews from certain areas of Israel, obviously in reference to what happened back in 2005 in Gaza. And this has set off a big storm, that he would actually encourage people to defy orders to leave areas when told to. So don't you find this, is this an amazing strategy by Bennett to really attract hardcore right-wingers, or was this a terrible mistake on his part?
Well, it could be both, and it could be that he was just telling the truth about what he would do and that it's a matter of conscience for him, I think is the way he put it. But Netanyahu obviously will jump on this, and it may strengthen his appeal to the right, to the further right, but he has been soaring in the polls, and this could stymie that for sure. You know, we'll have to see how it plays out. There's still a month till the election, so a lot happens. And he was very popular. His positions till now were moderated and modulated in a clever way. We'll have to see what kind of long-term impact it has.
By the way, this is a good time for me to announce that he is scheduled here for the 8th of January. He's supposed to be in our studio the 8th of January, and we'll let people ask him about all these different things that he's talking about, him meaning Naftali Bennett, here at JM and the AM. So that should be an interesting conversation. The Security Council in the United Nations has voted to condemn Israel 14-1. Let me guess who the one was. I assume it was the United States.
Yeah, that's a wild guess, but a good one.
14-1.
Isn't it amazing how the United Nations can act so quickly over houses, but the threats of Mashal and the leaders of Hamas to destroy Israel get no reaction whatsoever, no condemnation. But building houses, mostly in the area of your capital, in areas that everybody agreed will stay with Israel, that becomes a cause célèbre in the international community, and the United States, in fact, was critical of it as well. That E1, which none of these guys could identify or find on a map, probably not even in the right country, even the New York Times this week had to admit that it had made a mistake and that building E1 would not disrupt contiguity, meaning the contiguous territory of the Palestinian entity should it be created, and there are bypass, there are many ways to do it, but that Rabin did not, as many reported, say that this should be a part of the negotiations. He said that Israel will keep it and should build there, and so did Olmert, and so did everybody say this is an area you can't give up because it links 40,000 people in Ma'ale Adumim to Jerusalem. Secondly, when you need to move troops towards the West Bank, you have to go through this area and has strategic and other significance. But the degree to which they focus on this is really quite remarkable. And the violence that we've seen increase in the West Bank now, people talk about a third intifada. People talk instead now of a popular intifada where you have young people confronting Israeli troops, clearly stimulated, clearly organized. We see Hamas resurgent in the West Bank and increasing calls for armed struggle, that 88% of the people in the West Bank say they believe that armed struggle is the only way, that 42% support Hamas, and that Haniyeh versus Abbas, the leader of Hamas versus the leader of Fatah, Hamas wins by 4 points, 48-45 in a poll this week. So you see the increased tension, you see this the organization of a boycott by the so-called moderate Fayyad.
That's a boycott of Israeli products or Judean Samarian products?
Good point, because this is where the confusion. Originally, he had called for a boycott of settlement products. Now, and then he called for all the employees, the 10,000 Palestinians who work in settlements, get equal pay with Israelis, to resign and leave immediately. Not one resigned. Now he called for a boycott of Israeli products and trying to make it obligatory. Israel's economy will not be affected. It's 0.9% of Israel's trade, and much of that is transfer sales, about 40% of it, meaning that Israeli companies transferring items from abroad to the West Bank and to Palestinian communities. This will hurt the Palestinians, and the fact that, again, you get no reaction, nobody talking about the fact that at a time when they're all crying about the economic crisis. And if I may, there's a very important point, because our government, everybody has been critical of Israel for withholding the transfer of taxes,
right,
tax money,
right,
which they actually used to pay bills that the Palestinians owe Israel for electricity, water, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't say is that Israel's withholding Israel's money. This is not Palestinian money, because they paid 2 months in advance before. Israel gave them 2 months in advance money. So all they're doing now is taking back their own money. This is and it's completely distorted in the way that it's being represented. But the concern about, you know, this attempt to stimulate response, and the fact that the Emir of Qatar is now coming, and people think, well, he'll get money. Israel, of course, gave permission for it, but the post Gaza war escalation in Hamas's standing is being exploited now to increase tension and create problems in the areas, in the territories.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listened to, sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Spread the word, everybody. Seems like, thank God, our stream is back to the way it's supposed to be. And if you tune to your radio and now want to go back to a very, very clear signal on the web, would be a good time to do so. Information about the podcast at a weekly update, go to jmnam.org. To our homepage, you'll find information in the news section about the weekly update podcast. So I don't understand. On the PA boycott, South Africa declared that they're cooperating with it?
Yeah, they jump on this bandwagon all the time. And there are others who are in Europe and elsewhere who have been advocating a boycott of the settlement products, but it actually becomes a much broader boycott. By the way, one thing I forgot to say, you know, in the UN, the Israeli ambassador made a great point. He said that all of the people there are demanding contiguity for a Palestinian state that doesn't exist, but contiguity for an Israeli state does exist.
Nobody cares about. That's right. Fantastic.
That you have the continued link between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim, Jerusalem and the areas that will remain under its control.
I got to get that soundbite. And this was the Ramat Shlomo building, or this was the original E1 building?
But there is no building. This is only zoning.
Right.
And yes, this is about E1. They have Ramat Shlomo.
Right. So there should be another condemnation coming down.
Pardon me?
There should be another condemnation within days.
No, they're condemning everything. It's wholesale.
they do it all at once.
They just take it all in one shot.
Does, again, not to be too cynical, but election money in Israel, is it similar to here in terms of how government money is divvied up to those who are running for office?
I think it's divvied up based upon your proportion of the previous Knesset.
Could that be a reason why Netanyahu wanted to expand so much with Lieberman, or that's not a fair...
Not a fair
evaluation, because I would assume it gets them a lot more money to spend in the campaign, right?
Yeah, they get more money, and many of them come here and raise money, which is something I don't think is a good idea, but individual members have come here to raise money. The reason Netanyahu did it is because his concern was that he needed to be sure that Likud or the Likud bloc would have the largest number of votes so that the president would turn to him first to form a government. The concern was that maybe one of the other parties, Kadima had more votes in the last election, more seats in the last election too, but couldn't form the coalition to get the majority of votes. Likud could. So I think the concern here is that maybe one of these parties would explode and get more votes. You never know in Israeli politics. So by merging with Lieberman, it sort of assured that his bloc would be the biggest.
By the way, you mentioned the UN a moment ago, and are you aware there's a new book on Moynihan and Zionism racism?
I absolutely am, and I was interviewed for it and spoke about it. It's a very good book. I recommend it.
Should I put it to the top of my Shabbos reading list? Is that where it belongs?
Well, the top of the thing should be your Siddur and your Chumash. Then comes the book of Moynihan.
Yes. All right, a couple other things. I don't know if anybody in the Jewish world was closer to Senator Inouye than you were.
Well, there were people, Zev Wolfson in particular, the late Zev Wolfson, who, together with Inouye, did amazing things for countless institutions. People don't remember that Inouye, under the American Schools and Hospitals Abroad program, helped Jewish institutions in Israel, in France, and elsewhere. And even when it took a toll, people were critical, he always stood by. And maybe 30 years ago, I went to see him. You know, he was elected the first time in 59 when Alaska became a state. He was elected to the House for 3 years and then...
Hawaii.
And then since 62, he's been Hawaii's senator, one of the two senators, and the longest serving current member of the Senate. He was 88 when he passed away. But I'm telling you, Israel and the Jewish community had no better friend. He was in the Scoop Jackson category.
Wow.
He was so knowledgeable. And the reason why a lot of people don't know or is because everything he did quietly. He wasn't interested in headlines. I went in the first time to talk to him about an issue related to Israel. I never got to say a word. He lectured me for an hour on it. And I walked out of there, my head was spinning. This was the most amazing man. He lost an arm in a very courageous action as a soldier in World War II. And as a Japanese, as you know, they were discriminated against. And he emerged, never let it be a setback. He was such an amazing man. And at a time, he told me that he was considering, at one time, converting to Judaism. He, in fact, became an Israel bond salesman during his college years.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
so there's, we could spend the whole show talking about him.
I mean, where do you think it came from? Was it his parents? Was it a
mess? You know what he told me? He said to me, I sort of asked, you know, what the
right.
the
what's the deal?
Is. And he said to me that when he after the war, he started reading about what happened to the Jews, and he said that, and then he started reading the history of the Jews and why they were the targets of persecution and stuff. And he said there must be something special that so many people would want to do away or find them threatening or whatever. And he started studying Judaism and everything about Jewish religion and Jewish people, and he felt a kinship to it, and that lasted his whole life.
Unbelievable. All those who met him, I'm sure, feel he made quite an impression on them.
Oh, everybody.
Unbelievable. That's Senator Inouye, if you just tuned in, who Malcolm is remembering. Passed away this week at the age of 88. The Jacob Oestreicher situation in Bolivia, now that he's out on bail, is he safe at this point?
I wouldn't say he's safe yet because it's a dangerous situation, especially because those who prosecuted and persecuted him and took away his property have been put in jail, but they're part of a mafia and a much larger group, and they may find his continued existence, ability to testify, whatever, threatening. So he's got to be secure. The only way he'll be safe is when he's back in Brooklyn and home with his wife, who has done an amazing job, and his family. It's horrific what he's been through, and there'll be people to thank, Congressman Smith, others who intervened, Sean Penn. But I think those things are for later, and the people here who carried out the campaign. And I think it's, you know, we all did what we could, but really this is it's a miracle what happened. That finally the president saw that Evo Morales saw what was going on. As you know, they don't have relations. The U.S. relationship is terrible. These are Chavez people, and he was put the one guy in a prison with 3,000 horrific people. So his survival alone is a miracle.
Yeah, anybody who saw that TV program about it, my gosh. Hard to believe. What is Malcolm Hoenlein's reaction to the fact that Chuck Hagel, the former senator, might become defense secretary?
Well, I think it would be a mistake for American because of his positions. He has expressed positions on Iran, which I think are at variance with what the president has said. I think his positions on Israel, his references to the lobby, other things, I think that there are better choices. And I hope that we will see soon, but I hope that they will look for an alternative.
Have you had any direct encounters in your career with Hagel?
I've met him, but I really have had very limited exposure. I know Senator Kerry very well, who
right.
is the Secretary of State, and saw him this week, and I'm really not...
Are there any other potential, you know, the people whose names have been out there in the media in terms of positions for the second Obama administration? Is there anybody else who you would put in that category of being wary of, just like you are with Chuck Hagel?
Well, we don't know who's going to be getting the other positions yet. The only two that have been really focused on are Secretary of State. We don't know who will get Chief of Staff, which is a critical position, if Susan Rice will stay at the U.N., or who her replacement could be. The same the other positions to look at is who will be the head of the CIA. I guess if in fact Jack Lew goes to Treasury, then the Chief of Staff, and then who heads the National Security Council. I think those are some of the key positions that we should be watching.
Were you surprised that the State Department Secretary, State Department Security Chief, rather, had to resign after the Benghazi investigation?
When the report came out, two important reports came out this week on security matters. One on the Benghazi, and somebody had to go, and it protects the people further up. But the bottom line was that there were really bad failures. I think that there's many more people who will still be held to account or on whose records this will be a blot. But there were four people who resigned.
Right.
All felt a responsibility. The other security report, and I'm sure you're going to raise it, was the damage assessment that came out on Pollard this week, which was truly remarkable. It was written in 1987, but only gotten released because of a Freedom of Information Act suit. And it shows that he did not spy on the United States. He did spy, but and released documents that he shouldn't. He committed a crime, but it wasn't treasonous or espionage on the United States. It was about Arab countries and Pakistan and other countries, and Israel did not ask for information on the United States itself. So I think that a lot of the charges and the vitriol should be reconsidered, and it's certainly time now. This is a good reason for the president to act before his 10,000th day in prison to let him go.
I thought that that report was similar to what we've always known, that it was not treasonous activity. Wasn't he always classified as spying for spying for the benefit of a friendly country? Or
well, the term treason was used, especially in media reports. Even Caspar Weinberger, before he died, did say and finally turned around on the issue, but did say that it wasn't treason. And I think a lot of the things that people thought he did was actually done by Ames and by others, perhaps. But the disproportion, the level of persecution, the way that his whole case has been treated, there were mistakes and certainly his actions, but he's expressed remorse. He admits that he committed the crime.
Right.
It's so disproportionate. But this report is really critical because it's their assessment, it's the government assessment of what he did. Now, this information must have been shared, certainly with the courts, with the judges and others. So if they knew what the real nature of his activities were, it raises a lot of questions.
Mm. So the latest report from Egypt is now, at least according to the Jerusalem Post sitting in front of me, that the Islamists are staging a rally. So I will ask you my weekly question. This is now a rally that is against the president of Egypt or pro the president of Egypt?
Both. There are rallies.
It's crazy. I can't. You hear about protests in Egypt, I have no idea who's on whose side anymore.
If you look at what's happened this week, and we have to talk a little bit about Iran and Syria, I know, but if you take each one, you can never tell whose side, which side
exactly.
is on anymore.
It's
because
so
some
frustrating.
People are on both sides.
Right.
Now, this demonstration is actually against, it's for the president, for Morsi, because it's Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations today, and the turnout is, I don't think, is so far as large as they had anticipated. But there were demonstrations by the Democrats. It seems to be fizzling, the protests against this new constitution, which in and of itself doesn't impose Sharia. It sets the framework for Sharia, and it has things on blasphemy and other things that are of great concern. So right now it looks like he's going to get it through. In part, the army is not going to protest because their 30% of the economy is protected. Others are protected, and there was the mobilization by the Muslim Brotherhood of their supporters dominated the vote, certainly in the first week.
Wow, unbelievable. You go to Syria, and the fear, of course, was that chemical weaponry would be used against certain groups and that they would try to quell the demonstrations and protests there in a very serious manner. That actually happened this week. Not chemical weapons, right, but some very strong action that took place by the Syrian government.
There were strong actions by both sides. The Syrian government, and there are reports now that they may have launched another type of Scud missile. People are beginning to focus on the day after, something we've talked about.
Right.
And there's talk that what Assad is doing is preparing these chemical weapons, and they found from a defector this week who reported that they have trucks which are outfitted with both storage and mixing facilities, you know, to take the various components to, that are mobile and therefore could be launched from any location, but that he's going to withdraw these to the Alawite enclave, the area where the Alawites in Syria have, if he has to withdraw, and it will be deterrent against the revenge that everybody expects will be coming. The vice president of Syria, Ashara, admitted that he doesn't think that they can win. This defector also reported that there were two Lebanese who came to one of the sites and took 100 kilograms of these chemical weapons in the beginning of the year, and then came back for training on how to use them, how to mix them, and handle them. So the fact is that you may already have some distribution. What it was interesting that the United Nations reported that Hezbollah is fighting for Assad. I don't know how they discover these things. Always so brilliant, and that Iran confirmed that the IRGC is fighting for Assad. The Russians, it seems, are taking somewhat of a mixed view. A Russian fleet came to the Mediterranean, but their destroyer called in Tehran, and they sort of are expressing some reservations now publicly about Assad. The fighting this week that broke out new was involving the Palestinians in the Yarmouk camp, where some of them are pro-rebel, the PFLP, are pro-Assad, and most of them are supporting the rebels, but you had them shooting each other and shooting by both groups against each other, so you had a big outpouring of people, Palestinians, into Lebanon, some to Jordan, and the PA said that they would take some, but what we see is that the jihadis are gaining on the ground, that we talk to certain associations. Those are not the people fighting. This is something we've talked about many times. We see Al-Qaeda gaining, and through this Al-Nusra group, who is a very vicious, who are very vicious and are the ones who have attacked a lot of the army bases and taken the weapons. We see that the rebels are moving from the southern suburbs of Damascus towards the capital. They've taken over large swaths of land within Syria. It doesn't mean Assad is going to fall immediately, but I certainly think more people, again, are looking at the day after because he's getting very shaky.
Malcolm, can cluster bombs and Scud missiles both be outfitted with chemical weapons?
Cluster bombs cannot. The chemical weapons, you know, are difficult. They don't have the stability. Certainly bioweapons don't. But the Syria has the largest stockpiles, and they have things like mustard gas, sarin gas, nerve gas, other things. So they can be put on missiles, yes, and Scuds can be outfitted to carry them, but not cluster bombs.
You wanted to, and we're so behind schedule, but you wanted to mention something with Iran.
I mean, there's a lot of...
I know.
But the talks of having talks in January of the P5 plus one once again, and that 57 senators wrote to the president saying that he's got to be tougher on the issue. The Iranians are looking at Syria and worrying because they have such a huge investment there, but also they were concerned about what's going to happen to Chavez. Although the local elections, the gubernatorial elections in Venezuela, the Chavistas swamped and in fact came off better than they had before, with only Capriles and one other. He was the guy who ran against Chavez having won. So we see it, the developing situation in Iran, very much related to what's going to be happening. And we're seeing Hezbollah now, we hope, will be added to the U.S. by the European Union to the list of terrorists and explosions.
They're not on that EU list?
Never. Not yet. And it's really...
What?
Yes.
Al-Qaeda is?
Al-Qaeda is, yes.
And Hezbollah is not.
Hezbollah has not been. And then you remember they tried to separate. They said, well, there's a political wing and a military wing and all this this nonsense that they have introduced. Another area of concern that people should watch in the coming week is Turkey. The reports that the Jewish community there is living in great fear because there were accusations that Turkish Jews were involved in Mavi Mara, and the Jews say that they are very concerned about infiltration and the security forces not only watching them, but they're publicly talking about it, and it says that it makes them pariahs in Turkey. So it's a situation we have to watch.
Sounds like first period is starting at YNJ. You better get going.
It certainly does.
What do you know about Rabbi Mervis, the candidate and now the next chief rabbi of the United Kingdom?
The chief rabbi-to-be is highly touted, highly spoken of. and there were a number of outstanding candidates, and it'll be interesting to see if there's a postmortem written about how they made the choice of Mervis. But I know that they were looking for a different style than Chief Rabbi Sacks, who was a great success, a great scholar and great speaker, who has been here many times. So this will be a new era in the Chief Rabbinate.
How ironic that you're broadcasting from a Jewish school this week after everything that's happened over the last week. Amazing. And now it's a good opportunity to remind everybody again, if they're leaders of a Jewish school, synagogue, yeshiva, and they are not completely reevaluating security measures, then they are shunning their responsibility.
That is absolutely right. And I'm here because my grandson, Shmuel Bach, is putting on tefillin for the first time.
Mazel tov.
I hope everybody has simchas, and while we mourn the tragedies and the losses that we have suffered in recent weeks of individuals and at Newton, and we should also look to a brighter and better future.
Amen. Thank you, Malcolm. We'll speak next week. Malcolm Holmline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.